Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly podcast from the magazine that wants you to be able to pump your own gas in Oregon and New Jersey, even when it's not 113 degrees outside. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello, gang.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt. I really just want to say very briefly, but very proudly, that my first job after college was pumping gas in a New Jersey gas station.
You weren't you're not yet a
Phi Beta Kappa doctor,
but a Phi Beta Kappa pumper.
I was. You know, they called me professor.
Happy Monday to that.
One of my first really bad Al Yankovic type of songs that I would write in high school was about a gas jockey. It was called "Might as Well Pump." It was just, we don't need to talk
Please
about it.
Tell me there's no recorded evidence of that.
No. We did not know how to record.
There's got to be somewhere. Did you, your Papa Don't Preach knockoff?
Sadly, there wasn't one. Let's start. We're going to dive headfirst, Catherine, into the miasma of critical race theory. But first,
can you dive into a miasma? Can we get a ruling on that, Catherine, before we go any further?
Miasma is present in the atmosphere. If you were to dive through a Victorian, smoggy kind of, street corner into a puddle of
miasma is in the air. Right?
Miasma is in the air, but you could.
So then,
you could
what
dive
is it in the
air.
Ground? Okay, yeah. For some reason, I thought it was like a swirling pool of
it's
animal carcasses
it's
and moral
capture.
Turpitude.
Come on, Nick.
Okay, thank you. I've already learned more today than I'm going to learn the rest of the week.
There has been some sad news that I want to get into, so stop your jackanaping. There are some deaths in the libertarian and libertarian-adjacent families over the past week. Former Libertarian Party vice presidential candidate and certified madman John McAfee died in a Spanish prison cell, reportedly from his own hand. Over the weekend, Mike Gravel, the oddly endearing former senator who had a hand in the Pentagon Papers release, and he's a Reason TV video star, among other things, and a presidential candidate. He died over the weekend at age 91. And then yesterday, we learned about the passing of economist Steve Horwitz at the way too young age of 57. Horwitz was a longtime econ professor at St. Lawrence University, more recently at Ball State. He was recipient of the Competitive Enterprise Institute's Julian Simon Award, author of several books, including Hayek's Modern Family, Classical Liberalism and the Evolution of Social Institutions. He was a key contributor to the website Bleeding Heart Libertarians and a mentor and nice dude that is known to many of us. Catherine, you knew Steve. Would you like to share some thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, my first thought is just that death really sucks. Like, I'm super, super against it. And Steve was sick for a long time, and everyone knew it was coming, and it still really sucks. So if Ron Bailey could please get to work on immortality, that would be great. My Steve Horwitz story, I have many, but the one I want to share is just that he was a Reason contributor, wrote for us occasionally, as was his wife, Sarah Squire. And Reason played a role in that marriage. Sarah wrote a freelance piece for us about how libertarians should read more romance novels and wrote me back to say that the check for that article paid for her wedding dress. And shortly after their marriage, they co-pitched me saying, "We accidentally drank some red wine again tonight, though not enough to prevent us from sending you a couple of pitches. They are both intended to be co-authored, and the result of that exchange was a piece about how the state should stay out of marriage." Anybody whose wedding dress is funded by a Reason article and who celebrates their marriage by writing about how the state should stay out of marriage is my kind of people. And my condolences to Sarah, and Steve was a good dude.
I absolutely agree. I mean, he's really a remarkable intellectual, and he could be crotchety and cranky, but always following principles and ideas. I think Hayek's Modern Family is not only a great book in and of itself, but it's a great demonstration of taking libertarian ideas and applying them more broadly than they normally are to things like the family. And obviously, people like Gary Becker had done that before. But Steve's work, particularly in that instance, I think it blew a lot of people's minds, and it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, because it's a uncompromising, smart, and informed application of kind of choice and discovery process in an area that people normally just wall off from any kind of meaningful analysis.
I would just add that Steve's presence on social media, among other things that he would do there, is that he would kind of keep libertarianism honest. If he saw colleagues, even people he'd worked with for decades, slipping into apologia for authoritarianism and things besides, he would get right up in that and call them out and ask them, but not, you know, not in a super name calling, sweeping overgeneralization, but a very hyper specific way of like, here's where that thinking is wrong. Here are the errors in it. And I hope, you know, this person. And sometimes he helped by doing that create some course corrections in the behavior or the public facing commentary from some libertarians, which is it's an underrated virtue among people, since everyone has the natural tendency to just say, oh, you believe the good, you believe the good thing about the one thing I care about, so I'm going to look the other way about you being kind of a nightmare person in other ways. Steve was not having that even for a second. Peter, I don't know if you have anything else to add, or Nick, because you drew a breath there.
I was going to say, you know, on McAfee and Gravel, they are, you know, I don't think America has stopped producing weird, kind of wonderful, iconoclastic, weird, you know, just nut jobs kind of. And we should always mark their passing, because they're true originals, and they blow up the categories in a way that I think is extremely meaningful and powerful, and something that should always be respected and inspected. I'll miss them both on the flirting out there on the edges of the scene, either showing us where we definitely are headed or where we should never go.
Gravel in particular, still a top five campaign ad. The rock into the pond and the meaningful look and the walk. And if you don't know that, those search terms should lead you to it pretty quickly.
Will they? Well,
it's not going to lead you to porn, I don't think, for once.
No.
Those are our two choices. Accurate search results or porn.
Yeah. He was on the edge of the known world in that ad. It's really kind of wonderful.
Let us shift now to the seemingly overnight topic du jour. That's French for of the day, I think. So I conducted a search on the Reason website for the phrase critical race theory. And here's what I came up with. There are three pieces between 1994 and 2014. It's three in 20 years. There are three results from 2015 to 2017. There are three more from 2018 to 2019. Then five from 2020 and 17 and counting from 2021, including four over the past week. So what the heel is going on. I'm going to invite us, and we'll see whether we take us up on said invitation, to largely avoid the specific phrase critical race theory, or CRT for short, since at this point it's become kind of a marketing tool for those who are rallying opposition to its tenets. Instead, I'm going to read the selectively edited opening from a Wall Street Journal piece from just today by a chief marketer of CRT as a thing to oppose, Christopher Rufo from the Manhattan Institute. He writes, "Since the murder of George Floyd last year, concepts including systemic racism, white privilege, and white fragility have become ubiquitous in America's elite institutions. Progressive politicians have sought to implement anti-racist policies to reduce racial disparities, such as minorities-only income programs and racially segregated vaccine distribution. This has become the latest battleground in the culture war," unquote. There's some ellipses in there, but get the gist. Catherine, the proximate battleground for this stuff right now is the literally dozens of bills percolating and getting passed on the state and local level that ban or limit the application of some of these aggressively anti-racist methods and curricula being taught, especially at K through 12. Occasionally, it also targets higher education. As a school parent, Catherine, and libertarian, what are your general thoughts about these bills and this approach to that thing?
So one thing that's interesting is that the bills are very different. Like, this is not a case where we got a kind of ALEC-style model legislation that got propagated throughout the states.
Tell us what ALEC is.
ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they write model legislation, often with a center-right bent, and they try to help state legislatures pass what they see as good laws. So this is not that. This is a much more decentralized thing. This is sort of people freaking out on the local level and doing their own thing. As a result, some of the bills are basically just a reiteration of long-established principles about, you know, discrimination and speech in schools. And some of the bills are nightmare nonsense full of unconstitutional garbage. And I think it is important to make those distinctions because people are enjoying freaking out about this right now. And in some cases, they should freak out, but in some cases, they should not. Always read Greg Lukianoff on this stuff. Greg is, of course, the head honcho of FIRE, which their whole deal is defending, you know, free speech and education. They mostly do higher ed, though. So this is K-12 is not generally their business, but he is an excellent thinker on this. And he says we should call them divisive concepts bills rather than CRT, because that's a better catch-all. And I think he's right. So students in public K-12 schools don't actually have a lot of free speech rights. The Supreme Court made a stand for that 50 years ago or more, and then has really backed off some of that until this week, when we had a great case where a cheerleader who Snapchatted "fuck cheer, fuck school, fuck everything" got in trouble, and the Supreme Court said, "Nope, cheerleaders are absolutely allowed to say fuck everything in their own time." So God bless them. Maybe they're rolling some of this back. But broadly speaking, it is a bad idea for state legislatures to decide that schools shouldn't teach certain things. However, they are constitutionally allowed to do that in many cases. And I think this is a great example of where free speech law and free speech culture or practice diverge. The law is clear. The legislatures can say what public schools can and cannot teach. But boy, howdy, is that a terrible idea that they should not do. And instead, we should let kids learn bad ideas and good ideas together and try to learn how to think about them.
Nick, the RUFO worldview basically says that this stuff has marched very quickly through the institutions, from your Columbia Teachers College to classrooms, newsrooms, HR departments, the brands, they're out there doing this. And that basically once the...
Is Raytheon big on CRT
I
yet?
I think so, actually.
They were my favorite. We're still in Pride Month, right? And Raytheon, the weapons manufacturer, had a big thing of like, we support gay pride.
Absolutely.
Because our bombs fall on the living and the dead with equal
accuracy. It's the bombs, you know, the bombs.
Accuracy.
But the idea is that once the normals like start to come face to face to this, they're going to be shocked by what they discover. This is some pretty out there, you know, race essentialist type of things. Is that a basically accurate reading of how we got to this moment?
Well, you know, I think Christopher RUFO did a really good job early on. He got a bunch of, you know, training session materials from, you know, various kind of government agencies and schools and things like that, and published them. And the result, you know, the actual contents were pretty shocking. They don't map exactly onto critical race theory as propounded by legal scholars. But one of the things in the article the person that Catherine was commending to read on this, Greg Lukianoff, you know, he goes through a thing in a piece that's up at the fire.org fire site about, like, let's not be pedantic about whether what is being taught in K-12 schools is exactly critical race theory or not. But there is a rush in, you know, over the past couple of years, but especially since George Floyd, to have a kind of racial sensitivity training, which is pretty insane. And when people see that, and when they see what their kids are learning or being indoctrinated to, a lot of them are getting pissed off. You know, in this, I think one of the ways of thinking about this recent interest in this is it goes along with, and I know Catherine has talked about this, of like over the past year, where for the first time, because kids are, you know, learning at home, you know, parents are starting to see what is actually being taught to their kids. And a lot of it is really kind of screwed up, you know, essential. I don't think it's racial essentialism, but it's a version of history that is very much that whiteness is absolutely, you know, an irredeemable facet of American culture and American history. And you are bad if you, you know, if you benefit from white privilege, however that's defined. More importantly, I think, you know, K through 12 education has always been a political and ideological battleground. The early origins of mandatory public schooling was about how do you create better citizens. So it makes total sense that people would be arguing over a kind of civic religion. And I think what is really disturbing from a libertarian point of view is that when you start to say, we're not going to allow you to teach about, you know, one race being better or worse than the other as a way of, you know, ending the discussion of history, which is pretty, you know, disgusting in a lot of parts of American history, we've got a bigger problem. So
I would add on the discovering it at school stuff. I wrote a piece for us in, I believe, September of 2019, talking about the push to desegregate, some quotes on that, Brooklyn schools and all things associated with the kind of equity push here. And to this day, I'm surprised how quickly that spread from, you know, the rarefied airs of Brooklyn to seemingly everywhere. As part of that, like my 12-year-old daughter, who goes to school at the nice white parents' school, you know, she was taught Ibram X. Kendi this year. Like, that was assigned reading. He's the one who writes about, like, it's not good enough to be racist. You have to be actively anti-racist. She has a colleague or, you know, a friend who goes to a local school here who just reported to me, you know, apropos of nothing. And it wasn't like the discussion was being coached in that direction. Like, I'm made to feel bad about being white at school basically every day, which is kind of weird. Anyways, Peter, you're from Florida. Our next president, Ron DeSantis, signed one of these things into law. You, I'm sure, received just as many emails as I do now that suddenly CRT is everywhere, pro and con, mostly con. It seems to be people are salivating. Steve Bannon is salivating at the prospect of using this as a...
Steve Bannon wakes up salivating, though. So really, that's just like a steady background.
That hair is not going to slick back itself, Nick.
Oh, no. What?
Anyways, Suderman, it's my and possibly your instinct whenever something is elevated or de-elevated to a culture war, a culture war kind of issue, just to kind of wince and go, ah, and wash your hands of it. But is there not an argument that the marketing of this as a culture war is actually driving useful kind of marketing awareness for, you know, people who should be aware that this stuff is being taught at their schools or elsewhere?
Well, in one sense, you know, CRT has become a catch-all term on the right for left-leaning racial understandings or race talk that the right dislikes. And on the other hand, right, and it sort of has no real relationship to what critical race theory actually is in the academy, or at least where it started. And on the other hand, as you said, and as Nick has pointed out, some of this stuff that is being taught in schools and that is happening in schools right now is pretty objectionable. And again, to go back to the excellent piece co-written by Greg Lukianoff, published by Fire here, where they just sort of go through and point out, like, there's an alleged case, there's a lawsuit in which a biracial high school student in Las Vegas alleges that he was singled out for class for his appearance and called derogatory names by his teacher, that he was told to deny, that he was denying that he had internalized privilege, told he needed to unlearn, the Judeo-Christian principles imparted by his white mother, right? He was given identity confession assignments that he didn't finish, and the school failed him as a result. So it's not just that this stuff is happening at a level of feelings or a level of, like, this is uncomfortable. It's also that it's affecting students' grades. You have third grade students in California forced to analyze their racial and other identities, rank themselves according to their supposed power and privilege, and were informed that those in the dominant culture categories created and continue to maintain this culture and uphold power. Just a bunch of stuff like this. And there's a bunch of examples in this Fire piece. And this stuff is, in fact, quite objectionable and concerning. I'm not sure it's actually CRT. And so, you know, like I said, CRT has now just become this mush term for stuff I don't like. On the other hand, some of that stuff is quite problematic. And it is worth pointing out how bad it is, even if CRT isn't necessarily the right term for it. You know, the other thing is here, I think there's something sort of deeper going on that is not just about pointing to these specific examples of objectionable racial essentialism that's, you know, found its way into our schools. You know, I've come to think of this in some ways as a kind of refighting of the national narrative. It's about how to understand the history and the current character of America and what it means to be American. And character is determined in part by the story you tell yourself about your past, how you got where you are, what you did, what your choices were, and what those choices mean. That's true for individuals, but it's also true for nations and for groups of individuals that associate together. And so what we are seeing right now is a polarized, you know, quasi-political, quasi-cultural fight over the different ways to understand America's history and how to define its current character. And I think that, you know, sort of in part, that's because people just sort of want to have different senses of who we are. And it's also because the outcome of that fight is likely to change decisions, including many policy decisions going forward.
Catherine, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, this, I, you know, I've talked about him before. I interviewed him a year and change ago on the Reason Interview podcast. Wesley Yang has written about this in The Souls of Yellow Folk, and elsewhere, where he talks about we are looking for a successor ideology to a kind of series of meta-narratives that were propounded during the 20th century of America as the indispensable nation, America as an immigrant nation, America as a land of opportunity. We don't, to pick up on what Peter's talking about, we don't have a shared narrative. And in that vacuum, you know, various groups within America are trying out different alternative ways of understanding ourselves. And I think the anti-racism narrative, you know, we're coming out of George Floyd, it's much older than that, but the Kendi, Robin DiAngelo, white fragility stuff, which is not technically CRT, but is infused with a kind of self-hating cartoon version of U.S. history, where, you know, America has always been first and foremost about white supremacy, and that is its sole function. And every aspect and every part of our culture serves to perpetuate and extend and expand and essentialize or naturalize white supremacy. That's the story that we need to be telling ourselves all the time. It's a bad story that does not take into account history or, you know, complexity or the change over the past couple of hundred years in America. And it's worth fighting over, you know, even as it, you know, people like Ted Cruz, you know, has introduced national legislation to stop teaching of CRT, et cetera. You know, just because right wingers are often awful doesn't mean that they aren't right, that there is a real struggle going on here and that we need to come up with a better, you know, national narrative if we want to have a country that works together rather than is basically 2020 for the next 100 years, you know, where we're just arguing over things that are not particularly rooted in history, but rather in very, very sharply ideological arguments about the past in order to have, you know, particular political power in the present.
Catherine, about that sort of national narrative, which is a singular term that Nick just said, I have a hypothesis, which is that in this increasingly polarized time, where I think 30 of the 50 states are essentially one-party states, controlled all by one party, that every singular or every perceived like neutral institution, or what should be a neutral institution, this could be a public school, this could be how we do our elections, this could be, you know, this could be something as more ephemeral as like a narrative or a truth. All of those things are going to just be the battleground. It's going to be where everyone is fighting and deliberately trying not to understand the other and just scratching each other's eyeballs out over ad infinitum. One, is that a good theory? Two, what would be, should be a kind of libertarian takeaway from that or reaction to it? Or what's applied libertarianism in the face of something like that?
I'm a little bit torn on your hypothesis, because on the one hand, yeah, it does seem like people are sort of strategically seeking out battlegrounds, strategically seeking out kind of ownership of institutions that have a lot of capital, such as public schools or elections. At the same time, that stuff was always actually a politicized mess, right? And then if we did at some point have a story about how those institutions were pure or clean or objective or neutral, that is, you know, perhaps a brief mid 20th century blip, and it wasn't even really true then. So I've kind of mixed feelings on that thesis, but, you know, I think the libertarian response is, hey, actually the thing that many of these institutions have in common is that they are things that the control of that thing is governed by politics, that it's the state, and that, you know, the way out is to do things outside of the government, that we need, you know, we have a big fight about whether the media is objective or neutral or trustworthy, but we don't have to have that fight, or up until quite recently, we certainly have not had that fight in the halls of Congress, because people just turn on Fox News or turn on MSNBC or, you know, read Reddit or whatever they need to do. There are many, many, many off ramps from the fight, and people choose to take them when they are available. And I will say, like, I, you know, to your previous question to Peter, Matt, like, I am inclined to poo-poo these kinds of things when they pop up, just kind of in my heart. I am constitutionally like, it's probably not a big deal. That's like my first response to basically everything. Talk with my, you know, people in my personal life about how that's going. But so as a consequence, this was not a thing that was top of mind for me when I made the decision to send my kids to an independent school next year. But I have discovered, after having made that decision, that I'm relieved. I've discovered that I am relieved to know that I'm not going to send my kids off to school, and that they might come home and I will have to clean up a mess that a public institution made, in which my children are told that they are, you know, bad people based on an immutable characteristic.
By somebody other than their parents.
By someone other than me. And so I think, you know, I think that I have this sort of reveal. It turns out I have this revealed preference to not worry about that. And, you know, it's always tempting to go full libertarian on these matters. But here I think it's actually worthwhile. Like, school choice is a way out. Like, you know, if we don't want a tribal war of all against all over a single public institution that governs a very important thing, we should not have a single public institution that governs a very important thing.
Go, Peter.
So, Catherine, I actually am just sort of curious how you think about this in terms of the quite related wars over woke capital, which are not primarily fights about publicly controlled institutions. And it sort of seems to me that the CRT legislation wave is in many ways a response to Republican concerns about woke capital, right? About sort of the left values takeover of big corporations. But the thing is that where the Republicans don't have an awful lot of power in those corporate boardrooms, where they do have power is in a number of state governments and to some extent in the federal government, less so obviously this year than last year. But they have decided to make schools the venue for this, because schools in places like Florida and Texas and however many other dozen states are pushing these bills, schools are a place where they can exercise power. And so I'm not sure I quite agree that this is mostly about institutions that are publicly controlled. I think it's just that's where folks of a non-left political disposition feel like they can exercise some influence.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're agreeing. Like, yes, I agree that this is about a broader cultural fight, but the way to prevent broader cultural fights from becoming...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm with you on the school choice point,
the business
point,
of the
sure.
government is... And I think that, you know, this is also, you know, there's a long history of using the for the children justification to control adults. And this is a classic example of that they can say, we need to protect the children. We have power over the children because they have, per the Supreme Court, fewer rights, in particularly in the arena of their public school. So we're going to start here and do this thing here. I think it's also a downstream consequence of the perception that campus wokeness and political correctness bled into the corporate world, the woke capital thing. And so there's a renewed focus on sort of getting them while they're young.
You know, if I may, it's there is also this larger national narrative idea. And one of the things that we might think about the rise of what we're calling CRT in public schools, it's, you know, it's been in the making for a long time, where we've had a much more nuanced understanding of American history and the American experience, with all of its high points and low points. My parents, who were children of immigrants, you know, went to school in the 20s and 30s, and they were taught a very different national catechism than I was 40 years later, and my kids were 30 years later. And it's a much more nuanced one. I was thinking about this stuff. One of my sons, in an American history college seminar, the lecturer started off by saying, hey, you know what, to, like, you know, 500 kids, I'm going to tell you the history of America, where the founding fathers are not the heroes, you know, where they are not unassailably good, where, you know, racism and slavery is blah, blah, blah. And like, she was like, I'm telling you a history that you've never heard before. And everybody started laughing because nobody has been taught that. I mean, I went to Catholic school in the 70s and they were already saying, you know what, Christopher Columbus, who we learned about all the time because he was fucking Catholic. You know, he was an Italian who was sailing for Catholic Spain. They were like, you know, he wasn't really like, he wasn't just a good guy, and he didn't really discover the new world. So a lot of this.
I mean, there's a whole Sopranos episode about this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But and that's like 30 years after I was in school, or 20 years after I was in school. But like, a lot of this is truly shadowboxing about something that matters, which is, how do we define ourselves ultimately in the smallest, highest level of what is America for? What is America about? And we should be arguing about that story. Is America ultimately, you know, the demonstration case of white supremacy that can never be redeemed, or is it something different? It doesn't have to be some kind of weirdo, you know, WASP catechism from 1920 or something either. It can be, you know, but we should be arguing about that. But then we should also be looking at what happens when we focus on these issues constantly. You know, we have a federal government that is bigger and badder than ever in terms of spending, in terms of what it's seeking to regulate. And there's a ton of buy-in from right-wingers and left-wingers on that. You don't hear a lot of people saying, you know what, we really need to radically change the way the federal government operates or how much it spends. And that, I think, is part of the libertarian perspective, which is, yes, let's talk about our cultural narratives and what America amounts to. What is it for? What is its promise? How can we make it better? But then also, like, let's not, like a bunch of, you know, people like Ted Cruz, who, you know, where is he on the Syria bombing and things like that? But, you know, people who want to inflame on the right and the left over these matters, which are important, but also are not what government is doing.
Would just add that in public school in Long Beach in the late 1970s, the first couple of things that I was assigned in like third grade in terms of books about history were Runaway Slave about Harriet Tubman, and yeah. And also like a biography written for kids about Martin Luther King. And this is, you know, Long Beach is not particularly known for like super enlightenment.
It is considered one of the epicenters of whiteness in post-war America. I mean, right? It's like the town that you grew up in, you know, and I mean, that's not an implausible reading, but it's like, if it means that a town that essentially grew up after World War II by the 70s is teaching, you know, a narrative that America has not lived up to its promise when it comes to race, like, that's kind of a sign of progress that's worth kind of incorporating into any national narrative about America as, you know, the last bastion. It's where all the Nazis left, you know, when they ran out of places in Europe to be white supremacists.
Yeah,
speaking of race in the 1970s and racial narratives in the 1970s, there was a tweet going around the film Twitter world this weekend that said basically that on the anniversary of Blazing Saddles, a 1974 film, watch a whole bunch of people who say they hate critical race theory completely miss the fact that the movie's entire plot depends on the audience accepting systemic racism as a given. I mean, I think this sort of speaks to Matt's original question to me about whether all of this is sort of branding and like the deep confusion about what CRT is and isn't at this point. Like, Mel Brooks is now critical race theory.
Blazing Saddles, by the way, still holds up, in case everyone was worried about that.
Yep. And would absolutely is unthinkable in today's context.
We're going to get to our email of the week, also talking about fraught topics, potentially, in a moment. But first, friends, let's get you happier. As the summertime rolls in, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, emotional paralysis? You can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. We're not talking about self-help here. This is professional counseling. BetterHelp.com. That's H-E-L-P, like what Californians apparently need to stop wearing masks outside, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month. Other financial aid is available, even though BetterHelp.com is already more affordable than traditional online counseling services. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/Roundtable. Describe your issues and favored delivery methods, and you'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't jibe with that person, you can swap him or her out for another. Please visit betterhelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. Reminder, send your email question of the week to roundtable@reason.com. This one, and we received several versions of this request, but this is the one I'll read from Alex Hoffman, who writes, "Dear Roundtable, what are your thoughts on the ongoing civil war within the Libertarian Party between pragmatists and the Mises Caucus following the crackup at the New Hampshire Libertarian Party and the resulting fallout? Do you think a Mises Caucus-led LP would bring new voters into the party or just alienate everyone who isn't an edgelord? Apologies to the non-voters on the panel." Non-voter, you go first. What say you?
I mean, just because I don't vote doesn't mean I'm not going to, like, spectate this Met. Like, I don't ski either, but, like, I'll watch the Olympics for a few minutes, I guess.
Only if it's the agony of defeat. Go on.
Yeah, but I will watch for the crashes, and that is what is happening here. It is not great. As always, read Brian Doherty on the Libertarian Party. We lost him for like 3 days last week because he went all the way down the rabbit hole to figure out what was going on. And he has written a great piece called Inside the Battle Over the Soul of the Libertarian Party at Reason.com. So basically, I simply associate myself with Brian Doherty's analysis, which is that this seems to have been a pretty severe due process violation within the Libertarian Party. And also that pretty severe due process violation couldn't have happened to nicer guys. What a bunch of jerks these Mises characters are. So that's
Catherine's gloss, not Brian's.
That's my gloss. That is my gloss, which is informed by Brian's very fair, balanced, and factual accounting of what has happened over there. This is a thing that I'm always sad about. Like, I wish the Libertarian Party could get it together and dominate American politics. I would love to see that outcome. And I think there are a bunch of structural reasons why they struggle to do so. And also, this is a classic example of, you know, the fights are so bitter because the stakes are so low. It's a small group. It's a small group with limited power to scrap over. I would like to see a different world where that is not the case.
Nick, you interviewed Justin Amash, the most prominent libertarian national member of the Libertarian Party nationally.
In the land, Matt Welch.
Member of the party, at least. Last week about this very thing, and you have wanted to talk about this on this podcast for a while. So what say you?
Well, I think, you know, there is a fundamental tension in the Libertarian Party 50 years on from its founding, and it has a miserable track record. In terms of, you know, electing people. Is the Libertarian Party an actual political party that is trying to win elections at the local, state, and federal level, or is it not? And it hasn't actually settled that question. And as a result, it just isn't doing anything particularly well. Amash is very much in favor. You know, he's the only national politician who's held office as a Libertarian. He affiliated with the LP towards the end of his 10-year run in Congress as a representative from Michigan. He says, you know what, like, it should be a party. It should be a party that is winning elections and having major impact on stuff, you know, in elections. I agree with him completely on that. And then there's the question of the Mises Caucus and other groups within the Libertarian Party at the state level and at the federal level. part of what they are responding to is what they see as like a lack of energy and activity at the at the national level. I think there's a case to that. I talked recently with a guy who is very involved in the LP of Nevada, and he was more than anything, he was just mad that he didn't feel like that the LP, the national LP, did a hell of a lot over the past year during lockdown, where, you know, there was a very strong incursion against people's individual rights. And he didn't feel that the LP at the national level was doing very much about that. So I get that. There, your question specifically, Matt, or the one that gets asked more frequently, like if you are, as the LP of New Hampshire did, if you're tweeting out about how John McCain's brain tumor saved more lives than Anthony Fauci, it's not exactly clear what you're going to do other than get a lot of likes on Twitter. You're not going to expand the party. And people who are saying, you know, and you hear this a lot, that Gary Johnson, who more than tripled the best outcome by a libertarian presidential candidate ever in 2016, you know, that was a disaster and an embarrassment and a humiliation for the Libertarian Party. They got a lot of house cleaning to do. If your best performance by a factor of three or more is considered the biggest humiliation, you're probably not a political party that wants to win elections at the state, local, or federal level.
A couple things to add contextually to that. This is a frequent complaint among Mises caucus. The Libertarian Party has a bunch of different caucuses. There's like the Audacious caucus, the Pragmatist caucus, which was just dissolved because of this. And the Pragmatist caucus was the one that was backing Gary Johnson for two presidential runs. So that's kind of a big deal. But there's various caucuses. The Mises caucus, which is kind of associated with or like takes a similar just kind of worldview with the Ludwig von Mises Institute out there. It's like a five-year-old caucus in there. But they make that claim that Nick just talked about of like, hey, the National Party hasn't been aggro enough about lockdowns. The Libertarian candidates in 2020 for Senate and governor who did the best were the loudest about lockdowns. Joe Jorgensen, the presidential candidate, who many in the Mises caucus have sort of targeted largely because of a single tweet that went out under her name in like August of 2020 about she said it's not sufficient to be against racism. You have to be actively anti-racist or something like that. She mouthed the common term and that sent people into an uproar.
She's a socialist, Matt, and a collectivist.
I mean, she's not at all. She was actually a way libertarian on a lot of ground. She's a big like anti-vaccine mandate person. She ran against that. She ran against lockdowns very strongly, as she ran against war in a way that also Mises caucus people tend to be.
She also had the second best, you know, results of any Libertarian Party candidate in absolute and relative terms.
Which is pretty interesting, but better than most people thought she did. So to just some context there, Peter, you're from Florida. As you well know, there was a big crack up in the Florida Libertarian Party 5 or 6 years ago involving an alt-right character named Augustus Invictus. What say you?
Yeah, thanks. I say... Yeah, I say that. I do recall that name. I couldn't tell you anything about that episode at all. So I learned a long time ago that I'm just not
speculate.
A political party person. And for the same similar reasons that I'm not a sports ball person, that I do not follow or care about my local teams, and I can barely remember the names of them, I think actually possibly in part because the Washington football team currently doesn't even have a name. But I just don't... I am not somebody who is exercised by being engaged in party politics. I think party politics can be valuable. That's not to say that it's a bad thing, but it's not something for me. It's not something I'm super interested in. Party politics, parties are fractious by nature, and they're always sort of, you know, there's always infighting in every single political party, especially the smaller ones, especially the ones that have less influence, because there's always people sort of jockeying either for sort of personal gain or personal power, or trying to take, you know, something that's small and not that influential and build it up. And they're just sort of different theories of what those small political parties are there to do. In some ways, what is happening to the LP is a little bit like the debate over CRT, just in the sense that it is about, it's about the narrative and about the story that the LP tells itself about why it exists and what it and what it's there to do. And you see a bunch of different theories of what the LP is there for. And this is a war about the LP's purpose. And I think it's pretty clear sort of, you know, who won this round, given that the Pragmatists Caucus dissolved. I mean, when that's what the Pragmatists are doing, then that tells you...
Because it seemed to them that was the most pragmatic next step. Yeah.
That tells you a lot about at least the current episode, if not maybe the long-term direction of the party.
There are people like Angela McCardle, who is a member of the Mises Caucus based in California, in Southern California, major player in libertarian politics, who is very committed to finding candidates and running them at all levels. And that seems to me, you know, that should definitely, regardless of your ideological flavor, that's what the Libertarian Party needs to be doing, because that's their... you know, unique selling proposition, that they're a political party. And, you know, there are mixed messages coming out of the Mises Caucus where some are saying, you know, we shouldn't be running for president or for Senate or for statewide office because we have no chance of winning. Other people talk about how, you know, that's actually pragmatic because those are the things that get you statewide automatic ballot access and whatnot. And, you know, it's frustrating to watch these kinds of meltdowns. And there are a lot of edgelords and people who are just want to use the LP as a way of like maximizing their Twitter following or, you know, raising money and becoming better known without any interest in actually running for or holding office in any kind of serious way.
So this weekend, Nick and I were in Park City, Utah at Reason's first sort of donor gathering since the pandemic. And it was lovely and actually pretty fun. And one of the things that we did there was give an award to Ed and Alicia Clark of the Clark Koch campaign of 1980. And Alicia Clark gave really excellent remarks in which she basically said, "My father was a politician in Mexico, and I am not interested in politics. And then my husband became a libertarian and introduced me to the ideas. And we went around the country just trying to promote libertarian ideas." And she said, "I still don't care about politics. I care about freedom. I care about liberty. And this was the way that I could make the world freer." And it was good. Like, it was just like a very short, very simple statement from, you know, an older lady who has seen some shit and had distilled it down to the thing that matters. And I do think that that spirit does exist in the Libertarian Party. I know I was being grumpy and cynical earlier because that's who I am as a person. But, you know, nobody has bested the Clark Koch campaign. Not really. That was probably the Libertarian Party's high point in terms of success, optimism, ambition. And I think it's partially because it was animated by that spirit.
I have a pointless anecdote about Ed Clark. I was at the Libertarian Party convention in California, I want to say in 2018, it could have been 2019. And a person who's semi-prominent character who's been involved with the Libertarian Party and other pursuits, who I won't name because it's a semi-private conversation, but was interviewing me for his own YouTube thing. And he was like trying to say, "Oh, you know, Matt Welch is cutting edge libertarian," or something, which by that's funny already. But unlike, you know, and he gestured in the direction of like, unlike, you know, sort of old dudes like that. And he pointed unknowingly at an old dude who happened to be Ed Clark. So he was like trying to say that, like, you know, Libertarian Party needs really like new direction, and not just like some random old dude who's here, who's, you know, it's Ed Clark. And Ed Clark is more than a random old dude and should be treated with respect. Final contextual stuff I'll throw is that I wrote a piece, I think in 2018, with the headline close to, LP rebuffs Mises Caucus uprising or something. It was based on the 2018 National Convention. These tensions within the party that have existed for a while, the Mises Caucus have lost almost all of the battles, including for the chair of the party, Nicholas Sarwark, who's definitely they despise. He won three times in a row. Usually when there was a candidate that they favored last time around, it was Jacob Hornberger. They don't win. So this represents a moment, and there's been a lot of kind of takeover. That's their own language. I mean, they're coming in with a very aggressive kind of attitude, which I think puts people on their heels and asks them to and it prompts them to act in a defensive and ill-considered way, which I think is definitely true in this case. What the New Hampshire LP did and what some members of the National Party did as well, and a couple of them resigned, including Joe Bishop Henchman. I think it was totally ill-considered the way that they reacted to this. So these sort of takeover attempts are happening more and more. So this is really the moment of when finally the Mises Caucus starts winning. And it'll be interesting to see whether the attitude among the people who have held pretty good sway in the party for the last, decade, take their balls and go home or try to stay in and fight. And that'll, I think, say something about their character and the future of the party. And that's all I have to say about that. Let's go to our end of podcast, what you have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Peter, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, I saw F9. The ninth film in the main series of the Fast and Furious franchise, technically the 10th film if you include the spin-off Hobbs and Shaw. It's kind of great. It's a soap opera. It's a superhero movie, except instead of superheroes, it's about muscle cars that have superpowers. They brought back director Justin Lin, who had rebooted and revitalized the franchise, which started as this kind of low rent, not particularly creative street racing franchise that was basically, the first film was almost a beat for beat remake of Point Break, just uncredited and unacknowledged, but about street racing rather than about surfing. And they turned it into this global high superhero thing that is just sort of delightful to behold at this point. It's totally a soap opera. It's totally ridiculous. It doesn't take itself seriously, but it's very serious about not taking itself seriously and about the way that it delivers just complete absurd nonsense in the most enjoyable package possible. It is a great movie. If you haven't been to the theaters in the last year and a half or so, as many of you have not, it is a great movie to return to the theaters to see. It's a real big screen blockbuster experience. And it looks like a lot of you did. This is the biggest opening. It had the biggest opening last weekend of any movie since the pandemic started. Not quite as big, actually not nearly as big as previous Fast and Furious films. But still, it looks like people are actually coming out, going to the movies again. And this is the film that drew them to it. And I think it's a good movie to sort of restart your summer movie going.
Nick, what is making you furious, or at least read fast, or I don't know what?
Well, actually, you know, I did. I was watching the past couple of days The Good Lord Bird, which is a miniseries, a Showtime miniseries that debuted last fall, starring Ethan Hawke as John Brown. It's based on a 2013 novel by James McBride, which won a National Book Award and a bunch of other prizes. But it's about John Brown's attack on Harper's Ferry. The series is so good that it's made me actually restart a subscription with Showtime. And I'm going to read the book. But it is an incredible meditation on the righteousness of John Brown's cause, which is ending slavery, and then his obvious insanity that gets in the way of his better judgment. And it doesn't resolve all the tensions. I mean, it's both funny and incredibly deeply moving. It's told through the eyes of a young black boy who is a slave who John Brown adopts as his daughter and makes wear a dress throughout the movie. The book has been likened a lot to Huck Finn for a wide variety of reasons. And it's kind of, you know, it's fascinating to think about. But this is, I think, the best movie or the best work of art since Django Unchained, where it really sits with all of the contradictions, all of the hypocrisy, all of the righteousness of American history regarding slavery, and how do you get past it? At what point do you become an insane person when you're devoted monomaniacally to a righteous cause? And how do you actually change history? How do you actualize all sorts of things? But The Good Lord Bird on Showtime, you can also watch it on Hulu and a variety of other streaming services, is incredible. And Ethan Hawke, I just have to say, you know, is the one of the great guy, you know, actors, and he's also involved. He's a novelist as well. He was involved in the production of the series and writing it and developing it. To go from being one of the premier pretty boy actors of his day to his performance as John Brown is unfucking believable, and is worth the free 30-day trial that you can get at Showtime. But check out The Good
he's
Lord
so
Bird.
He's so scraggly in that show. He got the pandemic beard clearly before the pandemic happened, and just got the whole, right? Well, it's like, I watched this last fall when it came out, and it's just like, oh, that he just looks like everybody on my block.
It is, you know, it also put me in the mind of, I was in Buffalo in the early 90s when there were a bunch of Operation Rescue, anti-abortion demonstrations there that became violent. And John Brown is a favorite, you know, he is like H.L. Mencken, you know, has advocates on the left and on the right and libertarians and progressives. John Brown is one of these figures in American history that is both, you know, claimed by all sorts of causes and denounced. And he's just an incredible figure to kind of work through American history. But I read somewhere that Ethan Hawke said, you know, playing John Brown was like having a heart attack every day. And it is just a tremendous performance, as are all of the supporting roles, especially the young kid which is one of the best performances I've seen by a kid since something like Paper Moon with Tatum O'Neill. It's off the charts.
That's great. My 12-year-old was actually asked to write an essay comparing the approaches of John Brown and Stephen Douglas, I had mentioned that Frederick Douglass. I knew something felt wrong about that, and boy, was that wrong.
The Little Giant, but Frederick Douglass is a character in this, and to show what a fantastic work it is, Frederick Douglass is, of course, you know, one of the most righteous figures in American history, but he's portrayed as a kind of pretentious lech at various points. But he also has one of the great eulogies of John Brown, it's phenomenal. This also, John Brown participates in, you know, he was the Robin DiAngelo of his day, but with like lots of guns, so when you have a white person who is yelling at black people, you know, that they are not, you know, emancipating themselves enough, you know, it's a great, I was going to use miasma, but I think I'm using it wrong. But it's a great matrix to talk about issues that are very, alive today.
I was going to point towards that Douglass obituary, which is a remarkable piece of American writing. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I read Andy Weir's Project Hail Mary. It is an Andy Weir book, you guys, and I say that as an extremely high compliment. It is just like The Martian, if you enjoyed that in either book or film form. The voice of the main guy is more or less the same voice, and I personally find that voice utterly charming and would happily hang out with it for a couple hundred pages, which I did on an airplane this weekend. There is an extended, we have to science the shit out of this sequence, as one hopes for from every Andy Weir book. And when I looked it up just now to grab the link for the page that we keep of all of these recommendations at the Reason website, in case you are a podcast listener who wants to know about our recommendations, you can go and search for Reason Roundtable recommendations. There is a clearinghouse for all these recommendations. When I went to look for it, I found that this book is currently beating out all the Harry Potter books as the most read on the Amazon charts this week. Whoa. So, screw you, J.K. Rowling. Andy Weir is here.
My consumption is that earlier this month, the the second best website on the internet after Reason.com is obviously Baseball Reference. .com, which Nick will readily admit. It's the online daily updated encyclopedia.
Still waiting to be able to sponsor the John Lowenstein page, Matt Welch.
I don't think they do sponsorships anymore, although I have some legacy ones of Bobby Gritch, obviously, and others that you can find. But that's not what I'm recommending. What they did early this month was a remarkable lift of in coordination with the Society for American Baseball Research and some other historical sites, they went and cobbled together and uploaded onto their site the run from 1920 to 1948 of the Negro Leagues and the leagues that were created because there was a segregation in baseball up until 1947. In fact, many teams didn't have players as late as, you know, late 50s and early 60s even who were Black or Cuban or whatever. So the Negro Leagues, which that was their heyday, they're really difficult to find records over the years. You really have to track them down. There's about seven different leagues that have been recognized as being kind of on par with the major leagues of the day. Some of the best talents, like literally maybe the best catcher who ever played was Josh Gibson, played in the Negro Leagues. Anyways, they did this great lift, and now you can search and find all of the stuff. They have a huge page, and I'll link to that in the recommendations that Catherine Wrightley points us towards, where they do kind of podcasts related to it, essays, all kinds of links, multimedia stuff there as a rollout. And they just said, we are not bestowing a new status on these players or their accomplishments. The Negro Leagues have always been major leagues. We are changing our site's presentation to properly recognize this fact. It is great, people, if you are, especially the players like Minnie Minoso, Orestes Minoso, you know, who played a couple years in the Negro Leagues before he joined the major leagues. It helps complete the image of players who you might have already had some concept of, and you realize that they're also doing things over there. It's just the research side, it was such an amazing heavy lift that they did, and I'm very grateful to be able to dive in there and see a more complete picture of some of the greatest players to have ever played. And I recommend people look up now that you can see it and you couldn't before. The only player to be inducted into three, I believe, National Baseball Halls of Fame, Martin DeHigo, El Inmortal, a Cuban who played in the Negro Leagues, played in the Mexican Leagues, played in the Cuban Leagues as well. Probably played in Venezuela, who knows? Just an amazing two-way Shohei Ohtani-like player. And now you can go and see his stats online in a way that you couldn't back when I first took interest in the guy 20 years ago. Okay, that's all the interest we have time to discuss on this podcast. Thank you for listening. Check out all of our podcasts, Reason.com podcasts, including and especially the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, which comes out on Wednesdays. And who you got coming up Wednesday? Do you know, Nick?
Yeah, Eric Voorhees, one of the leading theorists and advocates for Bitcoin and other types of cryptocurrencies. We talked to him at the Bitcoin 2021 conference in Miami a few weeks ago, and it's a great discussion of the past, present, and future of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency.
Awesome. And obviously check out the Soho Forum stuff with Gene Epstein as well. And we'll catch you back next week. Thank you. Goodbye.